I'm Andy Herman. Am I too announcery? I'm working on my delivery. I'm Andy Herman, and I just had a fantastic meal at El Tapatio Mexican Restaurant in Columbus, Nebraska. And you're listening to Outside the Loop Radio, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Andy Herman, the original producer of Outside the Loop, coming to us from Nebraska. He is Nebraska famous. He's a big NPR star out there. And I thought, you know, hey, at first, was it the El Tapatio in Chicago? I guess they have one in Nebraska as well. Thanks, Andy. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's great to be here with you today for show number 997. And what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio. And okay, this is it. This is the final push. Today, Fitzgerald's in Berwyn, 6615 Roosevelt Road is the address of Fitzgerald's nightclub. 3 o'clock, we are taping the Outside the Loop 1000th episode. You could be in the audience. It's free. I mean, at this point, I think you could just show up to Fitzgerald's, but they say, you know, you should RSVP through fitzgeraldsnightclub.com. And you could bring friends. Did I mention it was free? It is. They have a full bar at Fitzgerald's. They have baby gold barbecue that they will be serving. So you can make a day of it. And you could still have time for your evening on this Saturday. So again, 3 o'clock at Fitzgerald's. We've got a whole lineup. It's going to be great. It's the 1000th episode taping event. And of course, we will play that show back on the radio and on the podcast. So if you yell loud enough, you could be on the radio. You could be on the podcast. We'd love to have you there to celebrate 1000 episodes of this program, Outside the Loop. And of course, you could go to OutsideTheLoopRadio.com, WGNRadio.com. Get all the info, but it's free. Come on, get out there. Fitzgerald's today at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The doors open at 2:30. Come on in. We're having a big party. We've got a live show that we'll be taping. And speaking of shows, we've got a great show for you today. We will learn about the Haitian American Museum of Chicago. Also, we'll talk about some local journalistic ethics and some new local music. The presence of ICE in our neighborhoods had many people on edge. And even though it looks as if ICE has dwindled a bit in Chicagoland and moved on to other areas of the country, the local conversation about having an armed, masked police force in our community who disappear people off the street was and is vital. How should local journalists cover something like this? Justin Kerr is the publisher of the McKinley Park News. That's an online local news site serving the McKinley Park neighborhood of Chicago. Online at mckinleypark.news. He recently weighed in on how his site covered ICE in the neighborhood, and he is here with us on Outside the Loop today. Justin, nice to talk to you again. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me back on again.
You are very welcome. So what you wrote on mckinleypark.news, I think, really gets to a larger topic of journalistic ethics, and specifically about the kind of language journalists use when reporting on something like ICE in our communities. So tell us why you wanted to weigh in on this issue.
Well, it came up in the course of reporting. You know, we are a tiny publication and kind of focus on what we're able to focus on. The topic of ICE raids in the community came up at a CAPS meeting, which we were covering. And then when we were integrating our coverage of what happened at the CAPS meeting and the great concern that people voiced at the CAPS meeting, and you even had the police saying, yeah, people are afraid to come outside of their houses. You know, it raised questions about how do we discuss what's going on with the raids in our community? How do we even report on supposed raids when, you know, ICE is operating as a secret police force and not releasing any information about their activities mm-hmm. and who they, you know, grab and what they do with them and, you know, kind of ignoring due process and things like that. And a lot of it comes back to, you know, who do we publish the news for? And, it, you know, for us, it's not, we're not an advocacy publication. We want to inform our neighborhood. We want to inform our neighbors about what's going on and use language that most accurately reflects what's going on, you know, according to our best estimation of it. There's a lot of sort of an easy and natural tendency for news media to automatically adopt the language of the entity that's, you know, performing the operations. So in this case, you know, ICE might be portraying their actions as arrests. And then when I was thinking about it as a journalist, I'm like, are these really arrests? You know, there's no due process. There's no Miranda rights. People are being brutalized. I mean, I think a baby was tear gassed in all part of this. And so is that really accurate language to use? And we decided not to use sort of the standard language, the safe language, and instead do something which I feel is more accurate and use terms like abduction and secret police and things like that, because that's really more of an accurate description of what's actually going on.
And you're seeing, you know, in the national news or, you know, sort of the bigger publications, I mean, I think to your point, they might use language like arrest instead of abduction, like you're saying. And you've said that when journalists use these certain words in this context, it's almost like these words can normalize the behavior. And we know that we're not living in a normal time right now.
Absolutely. It's, you know, one of the terms that people use is called framing, in terms of what type of language is used to describe an incident. And there's a lot of, you know, warfare or like kind of this verbal linguistic warfare going on over what, you know, how things should be described and, you know, the framing that's applied to them. And I think a lot of news media will take, you know, they kind of fall into the safe and default patterns that also happen to be very, you know, friendly with the powers that be and advertisers, et cetera, you know, by taking the safe route, by avoiding controversy. But that's also not accurate. They're also not serving the public with journalism by using these terms, you know, because they're purposefully obfuscating what's going on, you know, to me anyway. They're not directly speaking to news audiences about what's really happening on the street. And when someone says, oh, you know, such and such official act occurred with arrests and things like that, it is a lot different than, you know, unidentified masked armed gunmen, you know, rammed a car, jumped out, grabbed the mother and kid, threw them in the back of their own unmarked, you know, non-law enforcement vehicle and then drove off.
Right.
You know, so it's not, you know, the by news choosing to use that language, it legitimizes these types of actions and, you know, this type of action of the Trump administration. It gives it a false imprimatur of legality. You know, when the only reason this is quote unquote legal is, well, Trump says so, you know,
right.
All the written laws say, you know, our constitution and the laws say this is absolutely illegal. The judges say this is illegal, but they're still breaking the law.
Yeah. We live in such a, again, like a very strange time right now, because I think in mainstream journalism, there's this fear of seeming too one-sided. And this isn't a time where you have media outlets who appear maybe to be traditional journalists who in reality aren't, you know, and I think about the partisan sort of sides when it comes to news and how it looks like it might be real news, but maybe it does have a slant. And that's confusing, I think, for a lot of people. And maybe some people feel that that is news and they're getting their information from these partisan outlets. But, you know, we're also in a time where a lot of politicians say don't trust news. And so when you put all that together, it's like this, I don't know if perfect storm is the word or the phrase, or it's just kind of like a weird mix of like, well, is this real? Is this not? Can I trust this outlet, even if it's been around for 100 years? That's kind of where we're living right now.
There's tons of that out there. There's kind of this false equivalency between marketing and journalism. And I got to tell you, Mike, that's taking place on both the left and the right. And, you know, you see the right hand media manipulation all over the place. I personally consider what's going on with Public Narrative and the Chicago Independent Media Alliance and Medill to be kind of a similar thing on the left, where they're kind of setting up this hegemony of language and advocacy, parading it as journalism, and then, you know, and trying to take credit for journalism, which then, you know, makes the public trust news and journalism and journalists less across the board. It's really harmful to the news media industry and journalists who are actually out there doing their thing. The other thing that I think it's important to note is, you know, there's the sane washing aspect of all of this language, and it's very like established media has a vested interest to make things seem like they're normal. Nobody talks about how the mainstream media, including publications like the New York Times or, you know, hard-hitting news outlets, they make so much more money when Trump is in power than when he is not. They have a vested business interest to continue to perpetuate this insane situation, because insane situations turn into, you know, lots of readers and lots of clicks and lots of news, right? So I think that that no news media has kind of, you know, reckoned with that and asked themselves, you know, gee, are we pushing Trump? Are we helping Trump? And by not telling the full story, by making him look normal, and, you know, there's a lot of money behind doing a lot of vested interest to do that, to keep the hot news going and keep the clicks going and continue to push our attention economy. And that's something that really hasn't been said or reckoned in terms of that discussion.
Yeah, well, there's a lot more to kind of dive into here. I'm sure we will in the future, but bottom line here, journalists need to call it what it is. They have a duty, I think. You know, the press has a duty to speak truth to power, and that's always been the case. And boy, we need it now more than ever, I would say. And we can follow along what you're up to, Justin, and everyone over at McKinley Park News. McKinleyPark.news is that website, and Justin Kerr is the publisher of McKinley Park News, a local online news site serving the McKinley Park neighborhood in Chicago. Hey, Justin, it's always great talking local journalism with you, man. I really appreciate it. And thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I so appreciate the chance to talk and canoodle about these issues. And yeah, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me on again.
Earlier this week, I was able to stop by the practice space of Rich Klevgaard, who is the frontman, the songwriter for the band These Peaches. We talked about some new music that that band has coming out and just about playing in Chicago. This is what it sounds like. I feel very special because this is like the super secret practice space of Rich Klevgaard and These Peaches. Maybe it's not that secret, but this is a very nice practice space. Thanks for having me over, Rich. You are the front man. You are the songwriter. You play guitar. Thanks for having us over, man. Appreciate it.
Absolutely, Mike. So always glad to have you.
Well, it's good to be here. So let's talk about your music, because we're hearing some new music. This is pretty cool. So your music, you know, it's got that Americana kind of vibe to it. Definitely some rock and roll and other influences. But how do you tell people, like, yeah, I play music, this is what it sounds like? How do you describe it?
It's probably one of the best questions you could conceivably ask. It's a hard question to answer. I have a lot of people do comparisons, and that makes it somewhat easier. The Americana is still a genre that's kind of defining itself. I mean, ultimately, the roots are deep in blues and folk, rock from all the different decades. And, you know, there's a few standout artists that are doing it really well. And those are the guys that I listen to, admire, both men and women.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, it's interesting because I was listening to some of your new music. And I think I was listening with my son, and we had just heard a little bit of Tom Petty on the radio, and he's like, oh, is that more of the Tom Petty? I'm like, it's kind of in that same vein. So my 10-year-old Mikey just, I think, gave you a little compliment there.
Oh, yeah. I love Tom Petty. I listened to him for many years. I think my first album was Damn the Torpedoes.
So let's talk about what you've got going on here, this music. So you've been playing music for a long time. You've been playing in Chicago for a long time. So the new stuff that you have out right now, I know that you've been working on this for a while. Tell us about this EP that's coming out. You've got some singles out now, but tell us about the new music.
The new music. Well, first off, the EP Wait For Me Now was written in the early part of my performing here in Chicago. I've only been doing this theoretically about 11, 12 years as a project, writing songs, learning how to perform them, teaching musicians how to play them, getting in the studio, recording them. So that work was started in 2017, finished in 2019, and sat on the shelf for about 6 years.
Nice. So what made you say, okay, it's time. It's time to get back to the music here.
I wanted this music just to get out into the public. I wasn't certain of it when I got everything back from the studio. It had been worked on up in a studio in Evanston with a collection of musicians. It was down in Austin, Texas, being worked on by Rob Seidenberg. He brought in a few more musicians, including himself, and backup singers. It became a really, really slick, full production idea. It was more than I imagined it when I first set about writing the songs. And I wasn't quite sure whether I could feel comfortable putting out. It seemed a bit removed. But over the years, I've performed all those songs live, and they truly are a part of me, and I'm looking forward to being able to go out and on the stage and perform them, you know, as true as possible to this new sound production that we had going on. So why now? I have a boatload of other songs I'm in the midst of demoing, actually here in this room, and once I get all this stuff that's been sitting on the shelf just pushed out the door, then I know that people who want to understand, listen to these peaches, will have a chance to, and it's a different sound. There are the comparisons, certainly, but it's singer-songwriter, but it's definitely got a little, you know, a little turbo drive on it with a full band backing it.
Yeah, so the single, Speckled Bird, it's a really cool song. Tell us a little bit about that. So that's the single. That was your first single, is that right, of this batch?
From this batch, yeah, the first single. Speckled Bird was written kind of as a funny little story, a narrative. I try to do it as a third-person idea. The music came pretty easily, the melodies came pretty easily, and the words were just sort of redrafted. And last summer I sat in here with Cecilia Downey, who's the daughter of one of my co-writers and collaborators, Gordon Downey. Not to be confused with the Tragically Hip,
right?
Rest in peace. But Gordon's daughter had spent a couple years in Spain doing recording, engineering, mixing, mastering. And this room became an opportunity for her to plug in and take advantage of the acoustics and make this little shop here produced that song. So Speckled Bird came out of here wholeheartedly. We brought in Michael Kraniak, local Michael Kraniak on bass, Brian Doherty, who I've worked with over the years, both on stage and in the recording studio, Andon Davis, another guitarist here in Chicago, fantastic, and he's always been a go-to man for my very first album, Almost Through the Ocean. And Cecilia put her voice on it as well, which I was completely flattered and blown away. So Speckled Bird, it took flight, and a lot of people seem to really enjoy it. And it's showing up in a lot of playlists right now, evidently. I'm gone tonight.
So what's next here? So you've got some new music, you're getting it out into the public. What's coming up down the line? How can we get this stuff? How can we consume it? How can we get some of these peaches?
These peaches are on all the platforms. You can Google these peaches. It's not them peaches or those peaches. And it does get mixed up with a few other peaches names out there, but These Peaches is primarily a project that I conceived of. It came out of just being a little vulnerable about this music that I'd never written before, or much less performed, and I put out an album. Richard Milne was kind enough to play the first single off that album, which was So Glad, which was cool. But These Peaches was a reference to kind of sort of a vulnerability for me. I wasn't quite sure of this material. And anyway, it was a launch pad for playing out and playing live, writing more music, realizing that nine songs, you need more than nine songs to get on stage. And so I started writing very heavily, very prolifically. And right now we're in this kind of the third wave of that, of a lot of new music that is going to be studio demoed and then ultimately produced here, hopefully here in Chicago. I have my eye on a few different studios. Hopefully we'll get into one of those once we take it past the demo stage. So what's in the horizon? Live music, full band live music in and around the Chicago area. Supportive of these singles and introduction of new material, which is still flowing very freely. So you can probably catch me. Likely you can catch me at an open mic over at Friendly Tap or at Roberts West Side. Friendly's, I think, is Wednesday weekly. Roberts is the fourth Tuesday of the month. In any event, that's where I demo new material to work on just presentation of some of these songs that are currently out.
Open mics, man, they can be a great sort of a great time, but also just a treasure trove of new music and experimentation. I love that. You're doing that.
It's really is a kind of a fantastic thing. Friendly's has really developed itself into a great room. There's a lot of talent there. There's always going to be a couple of first timers, but the fact that they got the courage to stand up and get in front of people and just belt it out, you got to love that. And then you also have some folks that have been around the block, myself included, who know how to work the microphone. They know how to work the room. They know their songs. And Bob Dylan saying, I know my song well before I start singing. You can see the difference in that type of presentation, but the room really responds.
That's great. So catch you out at open mic, maybe some more dates in 2026. We'll see what happens with These Peaches. And we could search for These Peaches on Spotify, iTunes, Apple Music, whatever it's called
Apple
now.
Music, yeah. Tidal, it's YouTube, Amazon Prime. It's pretty much everywhere.
All right, Rich Klevgaard, the songwriter, the frontman. You do so much here for the band These Peaches, and we've been chatting in your very cool practice space surrounded by amps and guitars and drums and instruments and electronics. Thank you so much for chatting, man.
Thanks for having me, Mike. It's great to see you.
Chicago has a rich multicultural history. And one group that has established deep roots in this area is the Haitian community. The Haitian American Museum of Chicago is located at 4410 North Clark Street, and its mission is to preserve Haitian art, culture, history, and community. They're having a fundraiser coming up on Saturday, December 6th, where all of us can get involved. We could check out the website, hamoc.org. And Elsie Hernandez is the founder and CEO of the Haitian American Museum of Chicago. Elsie, welcome to Outside the Loop.
Thank you so much. Welcome. Thank you for having me here.
You're very welcome. So, you know, I said that the Haitian community has deep roots here in Chicago. So briefly, just kind of like an overview here, can you explain what that relationship is, the Haitian community to Chicago? What does that look like?
Well, we have to start with the founder, the Haitian individual that came to Chicago to be the first resident, non-Indigenous person. So we could say because he was an entrepreneur and he came into the established business in Chicago. So his name is Jean-Baptiste Point du Sable. We now have the Lakeshore Drive we named after him. It is now called Jean-Baptiste Point du Sable Lakeshore Drive. So to start with, the individual, the first person, the first non-Indigenous, so we can't say he founded the area, but he did established the first Chicago, what we know now as Chicago. So he was a man from Haiti, and he was Haitian. So that's one great connection. The second connection is the Chicago World Fair. The Chicago World Fair in 1893. Most people are not aware that the only Black nation that was there was the Haitian Republic, the Republic of Haiti. Because there were free established Black nation in 1804. And so they had a called the Haitian Pavilion, P-A-V-I-O-N. So they had a building within the World Fair, and they were able to provide art pieces and entertainment and so on. So the most important connection is that at that time, African American were not allowed to go to the World Fair. So even though we had Haiti as a Black nation had a space in the World Fair. So Frederick Douglass and Ida B. Wells fought and protested, and eventually the African Americans were able to participate one day at the World Fair. So it's a big historical that has not really been told in Chicago. And so Haiti, the being Haitian in Chicago and knowing we were there at the World Fair and we were able to allow the African American to participate at the World Fair is a second big one. The third one is, as you know, Kwame Raoul is a Haitian American Attorney General.
Right.
So we have many judges, many professional individuals. We have a Haitian American Museum. We have restaurants. We have many businesses in Chicago. So we are here and we have established Chicago and we'll continue to establish and provide and contribute to the city.
Yeah, I think that's an amazing history. I mean, and you took it back to really the beginning here. And I think it's a really amazing community, and lots of Haitians live and work and thrive throughout Chicago. So when you set out to create this Haitian American Museum of Chicago, this was, I believe, back in 2012. Tell us what you were trying to do here, because I love the idea trying to preserve this story. So why did you decide to go found this museum?
So, I mean, it was deep in 2010. Haiti experienced a really huge earthquake, 7.0, if I'm not mistaken, and thousands of people died, and thousands of people were displaced. So I, as a registered nurse and in a master's degree in public health, MPH, I felt the need to participate at this earthquake to help the Haitians, to help my people, and I volunteered with the University of Miami Hospital that was there, and experienced myself the kind of tragedy that Haiti once again had experienced, and so many others. But that one was really hard and it affected. So the idea is, how do I, Haitian, I was born in Haiti, so I'm not totally Haitian American. How do I pay back? Like, I'm here in Chicago, really, I'm not saying living in luxury, but living in convenience and seeing the misery in Haiti. And how do I pay back? Because I'm not a millionaire or billionaire. And so what I decided, because I've learned with the Haitian that were suffering at the earthquake at the hospital, that they have a sense of resilience and a sense of also not complaining about the tragedy. And they had a sense of humanity in them. And I'm saying to myself, if there's this beauty in the people, and Haiti has so much history that impacted the world.
Yeah.
And the art pieces that it impacted the world is one of its kind. Why do I not concentrate on the beauty of the country versus the misery and the suffering? So then I will say, well, do I become a speaker? Do I do a podcast like you? Do I do a radio station and say, oh, Haiti's beautiful. Haiti's a wonderful country, da 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 da. And I'm like, that's not going to make it, because people already have their vision already what Haiti is. The media did such a terrible job on Haiti. So I remember as a child, my mother used to take me to museums. And the only thing I remember is she didn't stand in front of the museum and trying to explain the pieces to me. It was up to me to kind of give my own impression of the art piece, right? So I said, what's the best way to change the perception, the negative perceptions of the people in Chicago, is to provide what Haitians do best: art, culture, music, history. And where do you put those things together if it's not at a museum?
Yeah.
So that's the reason.
I love that. And that's really what we can find in the Haitian American Museum of Chicago. Again, it's located at 4410 North Clark Street. And you have all of that. You have the art, you have the culture, certainly the history, but also that leads to, I think, that preservation of community. And it's kind of like a hub for that, where people can go and celebrate this amazing history and then see the contributions to Chicago, because it's all connected, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We're all connected. I just gave you a little quick how the connection is from the beginning of the city till now present, where we have an attorney general that's a Haitian person. So it's totally connected, and people are not seeing the connections. And that's why we are here, to make sure that the individuals know that Haitians have contributed so much to the country, not so much Chicago, but in the country and United States as a whole. But in Chicago in particular, from Jean-Baptiste Pointe-du-Sable to Kwame Raoul right now. So we have contributed such great things to the city.
Well, let's talk about a celebration here that's coming up. And this is a fundraiser for the Haitian American Museum of Chicago. And this is happening on Saturday, December 6th from 7 to 10 p.m., Tell us about the fundraiser here and how we can get involved.
Well, I mean, we're looking for people to join us and to celebrate with us and to have fun with us. And at the same time, the ticket is about $100. I think we're one of the low-end cost for a gala in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And this fundraiser, actually, we just purchased our own property. So we will have our own property at 64623 North Clark. So we're looking for funds to help us build it again, make sure that there's actually a permanent home, permanent resident for the Haitian American Museum. And so everyone in Chicago should come and participate, volunteer, do an internship, just be part of family. And so this fundraiser is to help us keep our door open, and also to come together to celebrate. For example, the Haitian made it to the World Cup. Anybody that follow soccer,
right?
It's a big thing to do after 50 years, they made it. So we are jumping with joy, with excitement. And also November 18th was the big day, was the Battle of Vertier. That was the last battle against the French when they really beat them out and kicked them out of Haiti. And at that time, French was like United States. They were the big empire there. And a small country, small slave country, were able to beat them on November 18, 1803. So it's a big celebration. It's a big moment. It's a big change. It's a big accomplishment for the museum, and we're waiting for people to come and join us and be with us and be family. So it's going to be December 6th at the Ukrainian Museum from 7 to 10.
And we can get more information and get tickets on the website. Again, that website for the Haitian American Museum of Chicago is HAMOC.org. It stands for the Haitian American Museum of Chicago, HAMOC.org. If we'd like to get tickets and learn more about this incredible museum with a lot of history and art and culture and, of course, community, the event, the fundraiser is coming up on, again, December 6th. That's happening at the Ukrainian National Museum in Chicago. And that's from 7 to 10 p.m. And we can check out the museum. I know you're open Wednesday through Saturday, noon to 6, and Sunday, noon to 4. And Elsie Hernandez is the founder and CEO of the Haitian American Museum of Chicago. Elsie, I say thank you so much for talking to us today. I really enjoyed the conversation and learning more.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I will also add, and even bright, they'll charge people money that they will end up to be $108. If they want to save that money, they're able to drop the purchase the ticket at the museum, or they could call us and purchase it. So there's other ways that they could save, you know, that extra $8 to the other, to the platform. So I just want to add that to the public.
No problem. That was worth interrupting me for.
You know, every dollar counts, I would think. You know what I mean? $8 could go to donation to the museum or buy raffle tickets or something. And we'll have raffles, and we'll have also silent auctions. So plenty of fun things to do.
All right. December 6th, right? 7 to 10 p.m. The Haitian American Museum of Chicago's fundraising event. We can go to HAMOC.org. Elsie, thank you so much for talking today. I appreciate it.
Appreciate the call, the interview. Thank you.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 997 is done. I say thank you so much for listening to the show today. Thanks, of course, to Bob Ferguson, who is our engineer in the WGN radio studio. Come on out to Fitzgerald's later on today, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, outside the Loop 1000. Love to see you there. Have a great week. If I don't see you today, I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.